And welcome back to the Strange Horizons podcast interview with Tim Pratt. This is part two of the interview. If you didn't hear part one, you should go do that first, because otherwise, this might not make that much sense. We're picking up pretty much where we left off, where Tim was talking about his new book, Blood Engines, and how it's being marketed or categorized as urban fantasy, and probably not as paranormal romance. We'll get back into that now.
You know, it's not kind of your conventional romance plotline. So some of the people who've been interviewing me from, like, the urban fantasy kind of world ask me, as kind of a standard interview question, so what's the love interest? And I have to say, there's one cute guy in the book, but he's gay, so he's not really interested in Marla. There's really not a love interest. She's too busy for love. So I'm hoping it doesn't piss people off. So far, nobody's written to me and said, hey, you're pissing me off. And it's not being pitched as paranormal romance. You know, it's being pitched more as, I hope, as sort of action-oriented, fun, fast-moving, thrillery kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Marketing is strange juju to me. I'm just happy the covers are pretty.
The covers
know.
Are gorgeous.
Oh, Daniel Dos Santos, the cover artist. I cannot wait to see what he does with book three, which I just finished and turned in like last week. And it's finished. I'm so glad. I was hoping to beat the baby to, well, not beat the baby, to finish the book three before the baby appeared on the scene. And
to beat
it's
in
all
the
done.
Deadline sense.
That's right, in the deadline sense. You could edit me to make me sound so monstrous if you wished. But yeah, the cover for book two is just astonishingly gorgeous. Book one was beautiful, book two is even better. You know, book three has all sorts of wacky shit in it, so I look forward to seeing what he does. I'm hoping he at least does. Book three features the revivified mummy of John Wilkes Booth as a secondary character, so I'm really hoping he at least does like a preliminary proposal sketch that somehow incorporates the mummy of John Wilkes Booth, because that would be cool.
And I always worry with this, you know, the first couple podcast interviews have been with people that I'm also friends with, yourself yeah. included, and so I've the privilege of that on my end is that I've gotten to read these books in
right.
advance, and so I hope no one thinks it's too, like, inside baseball for me to be, oh my god, John Wilkes Booth is so funny.
You know, I hit on the idea, you know, as soon as I read about the Booth mummy, which was this whole thing, there was this guy who claimed that he was John Wilkes Booth, and that, you know, Booth was, you know, killed actually in this barn, and whatever, he was captured and all that stuff, but this guy claimed that he'd escaped, and it was all a fake, and it was a cover-up, and he was living out west, and he was really John Wilkes Booth, and he told his lawyer, supposedly, and then after he died, his lawyer picked up his body, and had it mummified, and toured it around in a traveling sideshow, and at some point the mummy just dropped out of sight. Who knows where it is today? Yeah, a pretty ludicrous story, but in my novel, I can treat it as the truth. Indeed, John Wilkes Booth did survive, he was indeed mummified, and now he's been brought back to life as a zombie by a necromancer in book three, which will not be out for a year, so sorry everybody. But but my editor, you know, I told my editor about it. I was like, it's going to be so fucking cool. I'm going to have the mummy of John Wilkes Booth. And she did not think it was a good idea.
Well, I was just going to say, a year from now, people who can read the book and they can share my sense of, did you ever think you would hear yourself saying the words, John Wilkes Booth was so funny?
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Sort of, seriously, John Wilkes Booth.
He was an immensely fun character to write, and he actually does some really crucial stuff in the plot. And he's vile, and he's vain. And he's awful, and he misquotes Shakespeare, which was something that, as far as I can tell, he did pretty often. He was a ton of fun, and my editor, she came around when she read it. One of the things she said in her editorial letter was, okay, you know, you were right. It totally works. I didn't think it would work, but it totally works. So, yeah.
So this actually leads very nicely to the next point that I wanted to ask you about, which is researching these kinds of things. Especially, again, in the Marla books, you have... I mean, you have this in all of your stories, but in the Marla books, there's a sort of density of weird stuff that wouldn't, you know, that has some connection to the world. It's not weird stuff you've made up. I'm thinking of the yeah. Aztec gods in Blood Engines. But there are also all sorts of magical systems. When you say any magic works, you do also have a lot of people drawing on real magical systems. And Blood yep. Engines, the technomancer's theory that we're all living in a computer simulation. I mean, that's an actual thing that's out there in philosophy.
Yeah.
Or in computer science. And you have all this. I mean, what kind of research do you do for these things?
You know, I read whatever's fun, and when I find something cool, I make a note of it. That's really all it is. And I tend to read a ton of mythology. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have a giant reference shelf. You know, if any time I'm in a used bookstore, I'm like, oh, myths and legends of Polynesia. Okay, someday I'll want to write about shark gods and lava gods and stuff. Sure. So I'll pick it up. And anything that's interesting just goes into the compost heap that is my brain. And eventually it yields wonderful fruit. You know, I had read about John Wilkes Booth's Mummy. I kind of got interested in John Wilkes Booth, and I read a couple books about him. I read this great book called Manhunt, which is a really nice detailed bit that basically starts when he kills Lincoln and goes through until he's captured, and I think it's like 12 days, and it has excerpts from his letters and various testimonials about people, and, you know, it's interesting, so I decided I would somehow work him into the book, and same stuff with the Aztec stuff. I'd read Aztec stuff, and, you know, finally went back to some of the source material, and I can say that the Codex Chimalpopoca is not fast reading. That is not an airplane book. It's kind of hard going, but it's got interesting stuff in it. For book four, I'd been reading all this, you know, I'd read The Big Con, which is one of the classic con artist books. I read this great book called How to Cheat at Everything, which is pretty much a con artist telling a writer how he does all these cons. So I decided book four is going to be my keeper novel. It's going to be Have a Big Con. Marla's brother comes to town, and he's quite a character. He's going to be a ton of fun to write. And also, that book's got wacky stuff about fungal magicians. You know, I was reading about the largest organism on Earth, you know, that giant mycelium colony that lives up in the Pacific Northwest that's possibly the largest organism on Earth. It's this huge thing. So I thought, wouldn't it be cool if there was just a crazy dude who worshipped that? You know, no indication to anybody else besides this guy that it's actually even sentient, but he insists that it's sentient, that it communicates with him directly, and that he's its disciple. Wouldn't that be cool? Because then he could do mushroom magic. And mushrooms do all kinds of crazy shit. They make you trip. They can heal certain things. They can, obviously, they can poison you. There are spores. It's really interesting. Wouldn't it be cool to have a guy whose magic was kind of all rooted in that fungal sort of stuff? So he's going to be in book four. Why not? I figured out a way to work him in. You know, I very seldom do directed research. I just kind of read widely. I read weird nonfiction. And whenever something sticks, I'll do more research as necessary. In Blood Engines, I actually go a bit into the history of San Francisco, which was pretty cool. I got to, you know, write a little bit about Emperor Josh Schwinwerton, got to write about how Golden Gate Park was created, which it's a long story to go into it, but it's pretty fucking crazy. You would think there was actually magic involved the way Golden Gate Park actually got developed, because it started out as friggin' sand dunes, you know? It should not have become a great big beautiful urban park. So in my book, I posit that it was literally magic that enabled them to actually plant stuff and have it grow in the friggin' sand in the outside lands. And so I read, there's this great book by a guy named Tom Cole called A Short History of San Francisco, which has a great virtue in that it's incredibly short, so you can read it very quickly. But it has all these really cool kind of details about the history of San Francisco. You know, I think to be a writer, you have to kind of be a voracious reader. And, you know, we live in the age of Wikipedia, right? Anything that looks interesting, you can get an incredibly shallow and probably kind of accurate overview. And then if you want, you can go deeper. So yeah. It's pretty easy to do the shallow research that novelists really have to do. You know, you want to do very wide but not terribly deep research. You could, I think it was Mike Resnick who says, don't do $3,000 worth of research for a $300 story. You know?
You mentioned that you're writing, you know, again, you have this sort of schedule with these books. You have to push through book three, and now you have to start on book four while you have a baby and so on. Mm-hmm. Are you still writing a lot of short stories or no?
Very few. In the past couple of years, honestly, short story output has fallen off a lot, which bums me out. Because first stories are my first love, or short stories are my first love. I was actually revising a story today that I wrote, you know, the first couple drafts of ages ago and just had not had time to get back to, but I have a little bit of time. I'm not quite ready to start book four because I know I'm going to be interrupted by a newborn, so because I always have to be working on something, I finally came back and started working on a story. But, you know, I used to write probably 8 or 10 stories a year, and the past couple years I've been lucky to get 3 or 4. I think they're better stories. You guys published one, Artifice and Intelligence, that I wrote not long ago that I think I actually managed to be brief, which is incredibly difficult for me. My natural length is something like 15,000 words for a story, and that I thought was, you know, a pretty well-crafted, put-together story. So I think when I'm working on them, I'm still doing good work, but yeah, the novels just eat up so much time. And with the Marla books, they're coming out spaced at 6 months, which is great. It's really cool that my publisher's doing that, because it's a wonderful way, in theory, to build an audience for a series. You know, when book two comes out, book one's still on the shelf. So I'm glad they're doing it, but it does mean kind of a 2-book-a-year schedule, which is a little bit rough.
Yeah.
But yeah, short stories, you know, I won this Hugo, and it seems like I should be really pushing that and sending out a ton of stories, and, you know, I got like 2. Pretty much my trunk has been sold at this point. I have very few stories that aren't sold that I would care to see sold. I, of course, have a giant trunk full of crap that I'm not going to send out. But, yeah, I'm hoping after I deliver this next book, book four, I don't have anything else under contract.
Hi, this is Susan, breaking in to interrupt the interview to say that we had some sort of massive technical failure. I have only just now realized, as I am editing this podcast several days after it was recorded, that something went wrong with our technical setup, and I have no idea what caused it, which is troubling because I would like it to not happen again. Because what happened is, right after that last sentence that you heard Tim say there, there's approximately 10 minutes of nothing on the recording. The recording is there, but it's all just blank, and I can't seem to make it come back. Which is sad, because in that part we talked about a bunch of different things, but I think where the recording picks back up is partway through our discussion of Flytrap. Flytrap is a zine that Tim and his wife, Heather Shaw, edit and produce together. It's a great little magazine. We'll have information about it on the podcast webpage. I am very sorry about this, but we will resume the podcast interview with partway through the conversation about Flytrap. Sorry about that. Has there been anything about editing and producing Flytrap that's you know, been a surprise or been unexpected?
Gosh, I don't know. You know, we've been doing it for 4.5 years now, mm-hmm. something like that. So it's just, I don't know, it's so much part of my life. Maybe early on, I'd always heard how dire the slush pile was, I guess, that the slush pile was full of execrable, horrifying, monstrous crap. So I was surprised, and admittedly, we have sort of 6-week reading periods, and we get it, you know, a couple, few hundred submissions, so it's not the kind of rolling slush pile that Asimov's or something has. But to me, I was surprised that the quality was as high as it was. The majority of the stories, it wasn't that they were horrendously bad, and maybe we're a tiny little niche magazine, you know, that not a ton of people have heard of, so maybe we're getting stuff from people who are more accomplished or who've been working at it harder, doing it longer, or a little bit more hooked into peer groups or whatever, or critique groups or something. But to me, the problem is that it's mostly just kind of eh. Most of the stories are reasonably competent. They do a couple things right. They're just sort of boring, or they're like, you know, 1,000 stories that I've read before. And it did make me think about my own writing in that respect, because there's a certain kind of little contemporary fantasy story that I can just fucking nail every time. Mm-hmm. You know, it has, you know, a little moment of revelation, and it has, you know, some romance and some interpersonal crap and all that stuff. You know, I'm told that I'm pretty good at writing characters, at kind of getting to the core of what makes people tick, which, okay, if people say that, I'll accept the compliment. That seems to be the thing people consistently tell me I do okay, is that I do people right. So I can write a little story where there's some realistic people that some magical stuff happens to. And I can probably keep selling them, but why would I keep writing the same kind of story that I can do over and over that I know I can nail? So I've started pushing myself, really in the last few years, I guess probably around the time Flytrap started. I started trying to branch out and stop doing the stuff that I always do, trying to tell stories in more nonlinear ways, because I tend to be a really linear thinker. My stories tend to start and they progress, and my novels are like this too. I haven't figured out how to do a really nonlinear novel yet. I may never figure it out. You know, my shit tends to happen over the course of a couple days or a week or whatever. I have a book that I haven't sold where I tried, I'm going to try to sell it once it's, you know, completely finished, where I did try to do something on a much larger time scale and something that was a little less relentlessly linear. So to just kind of push myself out of that comfort zone and tell stories in different ways and try to tell different kinds of stories that aren't just about, hey, this magic thing happens and it changes the way this character views their mundane life or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that answers the question. I tend to lose the thread of things.
We've, you know, talked a lot about your writing and the Marlowe books and so on. What do you do for fun these days?
Oh, fun. Let's see. I like movies. Yeah. I drag Heather to movies every chance I get. For a while, we were going every weekend. And, you know, if it's a really awesome, great, brilliant movie, that's good. But I'll sit in the theater and perfectly enjoy a movie that has all sorts of ridiculous flaws, and that after the fact I would pick apart and think it has all sorts of terrible things wrong with it. But I tend to be I'm like the perfect audience member, you know? I enjoy what you give me. As long as it doesn't bore me, as long as, you know, it keeps my eyes focused on the screen, I'm pretty much happy. You know, so my story, Impossible Dreams, that won the Hugo, is a huge love song to movies. You know, it's all about how awesome movies are. So I like that stuff, although I have no desire to be a screenwriter or actually be involved in movies at all. I like I like cooking a lot. And it's finally autumn, so I can make some chili. Nice. Although my wife is a bit worried about really spicy chili and nursing a baby, but we'll see how it works out, right? It'll be okay. I don't know.
What's the last movie you saw?
We saw the Darjeeling Limited yesterday, actually.
Yeah?
It's pretty good. It's like Wes Anderson doing Wes Anderson, sort of.
Okay.
He's a guy who's doing that story that he really knows how to do, kind of maybe too much. It would be nice to see him. It's a quirky movie with a really gorgeous color palette and all sorts of weird offbeat things, and it's about a dysfunctional family, kind of just like The Royal Tenenbaums was, and it's not as good as The Royal Tenenbaums, which I think is the best of his story, of his movies in that mold, but it's a visually really beautiful movie. It has some really delightful moments. It's set on a train, which you never see movies set on trains anymore, because we don't have trains in America. He had to set it in India to have, you know, a long train journey make any sense. Otherwise, it would have had to have been a period piece, and then he couldn't have had all the, you know, contemporary profanity and such. So it was enjoyable. I liked it a lot. You know, lately with writing and getting ready for the baby, I don't even remember what leisure time is. I read books. I take walks. I play with my cats, and other than that, I'm just doing loads and loads of baby laundry and trying to make sure the car seat's installed properly.
Speaking of which, you have all this baby stuff, presumably, coming into your lives.
Oh, yeah.
So what's your preference, monkeys or giraffes?
Yeah, well, Heather's a huge giraffe fan. The giraffes are her new thing. Giraffes are the new black. Yeah. But for me, giraffes are the new monkey, as she says. I'm a fan of the monkeys. I like monkeys.
You're a monkey guy.
Well, and we got a ton of great monkey stuff. We really do. Well, we've always liked monkeys, but we saw this New Yorker cartoon where it's these two kids, like young little boys, walking along the street, and one says to the other, "I feel such pressure to like monkeys." And so for us, that was like, yeah, we want our kid to feel pressure to like monkeys. Plus, they don't make that many really adorable little robot onesies, you know.
I was thinking about dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs are pretty cool. I wanted to go with the sort of, so you have, you know, the crib bedding has all sorts of themes. I really dug the dinosaur theme, but Heather convinced me that she wanted more of a jungle theme, so we went plus we have a cat named Zanzibar, and the name of the crib set that we bought was Zanzibar, so it seemed like synchronicity.
Yeah.
It seemed fated, really. So.
No dinosaurs.
Well, she relented and bought me the stuffed dinosaur that was part of the dinosaur crib set. There was a little Tyrannosaurus Rex toy with stubby little arms. So
awesome.
She did give in and get that. Yeah. For the baby, of course, not for me at all.
Oh, sure.
Absolutely for the baby. Because the baby gives a crap about that stuff.
Because I wanted to, you know, talk to you about something other than just writing, so I'm kind of working through my non-writing questions.
Right. Unfortunately, it's book and baby are the only things we talk about, really, and now that my book's turned in, it's really just baby.
the last thing I have on my list is I wanted to ask you about a comment you made earlier that you kind of started life as a horror writer.
Yeah.
Because that's one of those things that I know about you. You're actually, I don't know if I ever told you this, you're kind of single-handedly responsible for the fact that I am not entirely contemptuous of horror.
Greg Van Eekout started out as a splatterpunk wannabe, too.
Really?
So, yep. Skip, Spectre, all the splatterpunks. He was down in L.A. at the time, which was the hotbed for that stuff. He started out much the same.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was you lent me that Stephen King essay collection.
Oh yeah, Dance Macabre.
Right, that
Yeah.
that got me thinking about maybe I had misjudged horror, and I was reacting partly to the fact that I'd probably only encountered bad horror.
There's a tendency in horror to judge it by its worst elements, which is a bummer, you
Well,
know?
there's also the fact that I don't like, I still don't like it. I don't like things whose, purpose is to frighten me.
Yeah.
But I respect it, which I didn't before I really got into talking about it with you. But so why did you used to write a lot more horror?
A lot of it, I think, was early conditioning. My mom was a horror fan, so there was, a ton of Stephen King novels in the house.
Right.
I've said many times, and it's true, the first grown-up novel I ever read was Carrie. I was in third grade, and I read Carrie, and I
Wow.
didn't. I'm not even sure I knew what, like, tampons were. There was a ton of stuff that just flew over my head, but something about it just got me, and so I read that stuff, and my mom had a ton of books like that. She was a huge voracious reader, so we had, all sorts of, we had, Dean Koontz, and then I had, most of my family was kind of voracious readers. Another big turning point for me was one of my aunts had crappy paperbacks that she'd picked up at a yard sale of Clive Barker's Books of Blood. So I was probably like 10 years old or something, and I'm reading the Books of Blood. So, I'm not sure if I had a natural inclination to be a horror writer or if that was just the stuff I was reading that really made my imagination catch fire. And then I went to the library and picked up the first volume of the year's Best Fantasy and Horror, and that's where I first encountered Charles Dalint and Jonathan Carroll, and who were huge influences on me. And somewhat Jonathan Carroll, a lot of the stuff he writes you could properly call horror, I think. So that was, when you start out as a writer, at least for me, you kind of copy the stuff you love. So I was trying to write horror stories, which it's kind of funny to imagine, a 10-year-old trying to write about deeply horrific things, which are so often rooted in sex and death, two things I had basically no experience with. So as I got older and had a little more experience with sex and death, that was the time I started moving away from writing horror, and my reading got a little wider. But I, that dark streak still exists in a lot of my writing.
Yeah.
I admire it too. And for I write reviews. I used to. I haven't had time to write reviews in several months now. But I, for a while, was pretty much the guy who wrote horror reviews for Locus Magazine because nobody else really liked horror. And so I still keep my hand in. I still read. Tom Picarilli is an amazing. Writes really wonderful dark stuff. Anytime Joe Lansdale wants to move into writing dark stuff, I'm right there. I'm delighted to read his stuff. Caitlin Kiernan, who's not really a horror writer, but early on she was kind of billed as a horror writer. Her books are just amazing. Although she's somebody who's really stretching herself and branching out. Her newest book, Daughter of Hounds, is just amazing, and it has lots of really dark stuff in it. But I wouldn't call it a horror novel. It's a contemporary fantasy. With nasty things.
Kind of winding down on stuff I wanted
Okay.
to get you talking about. Is there anything that you want to mention or bring up that I haven't asked about?
I was just thinking, I had said the only things in my life are books and babies, and that's not true because the other thing in my life is porn. This is actually, this is 1 year in a couple days that I've been writing porn reviews for Blowfish.com. I've been writing video reviews, which after about 4 months of watching two porn videos a week, any erotic content is sort of pretty much incidental. You kind of just start watching it with that jaded reviewer's eye and kind of dissecting it. In theory, is this sexy? Would someone who has not watched 80 horror movies in the past several months think this was hot? So that's kind of fun, actually. That's my regular freelancing gig, and I get to be, irreverent and make dirty jokes and use swear words and stuff like that. So that's pretty fun. That pays pretty well. And I do a weekly column for them too, called Caught in the Net, that's just about like weird, quirky internet sites online. So I write a little commentary and round up some strange sex-related links. So that's pretty fun. That's the bulk of the nonfiction work that I'm doing these days. It's kind of neat.
I'm guessing that, again, works a completely different part of your brain.
Oh yeah, writing nonfiction. Normally writing nonfiction I have a hard time with, writing reviews and articles, and I've done some of that stuff. And I tend to find it a lot of work. It's a lot more effort than writing fiction is for me. It's just a much more, it feels much more difficult. It's not fun. Writing this stuff, though, is it's like writing a blog entry, you know, writing these video reviews. I can just kind of be as snarky as I want to be. You know, it's not like you have to write a positive review of this because we're going to carry it. I decide whether they carry it or not. You know, if I think it's, they carry it, or if I think, you know, sometimes they say, wow, something that's that bad in so many myriad ways, maybe we should carry that. Maybe we should allow people. We'll let them know that it's bad, but some people are going to want to see it just because it sounds apocalyptically bad.
Right.
So, yeah, completely different part of my brain. But I get to make stupid jokes, and God, I get to make puns on dirty words and things. You know how you get to do that in your life and get paid for it. So
that's true. That is not an everyday experience for most
people. That's true. You know, I always say my 14-year-old self would be really delighted that I landed this gig, that I have a pile of pornographic DVDs that literally stretches to the ceiling in my house.
It sounds like your 14-year-old self also, you know, would have thought it was a lot more fun to watch them all than you do at this point.
Sometimes it's really hard to watch two in a week, I gotta tell you. And it's not like you gotta sit through the whole thing either. If there's a plot, I try and see if the plot makes sense, because that's rich fodder for review porn movie plots. You know, I can burn 150 words on how ludicrous a plot is, usually.
Right.
So, for the most part, you can watch it with the fast-forward liberally applied. You get a sense of it, and then you can sort of move along. But, yeah, it's a pretty sweet gig, I gotta say. I hope it keeps up.
So we have the first Marla Mason book, Blood Engines.
Yep.
Out now.
Yep.
Flytrap 8. Out yep. now. The Tiny Pratshaw Baby, about to be out.
That's right.
Seems like a pretty busy month or two for you.
This year has been nuts. I had originally sold two books in this series, and then, you know, I turned in the second book or whatever, and my editor was like, these are good, we're going to buy two more. That happened, like, this summer. The baby has been, of course, incredibly huge. The Hugo thing was huge. It's been, you know, I turned 30, and it's been a wonderful start to this decade of my life, I gotta say.
That's great. Yeah, this again where I would normally ask, you know, what's next, but I think we know what's next, which is an infant in book four.
An infant in book four. Griffsense. That's right.
Okay. Well, then cool. We will try and check in with you again later.
Yeah, sounds good. See if I emerge unscathed.
Yeah. Well, it's really good talking to you.
Yeah, it's good talking to you too.
Yeah.
And thanks for interviewing me. I know I tend to be kind of a babbly, strange interviewee. I have no pat answers for any of this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I bring it every time, which I think is more fun for me. And God, I hope for the people listening to it.
Neat. So it'll probably take me about a week or so to get this edited and up, but...
Well, the baby could be born.
Oh my goodness. You're going to have a baby!
I know. Pretty awesome.
Okay.
Okay.
I should get going. I will let you know when this goes up.
All right.
And, yeah, it was very good talking to you.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
And that concludes our interview with Tim Pratt. Thank you for listening to the Strange Horizons podcast, and we hope to see you again soon when we have our next podcast interview. Thanks.